You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, July 14th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, assistant professor of sociology at Purdue University, affiliated scholar of the American Bar Foundation, Spencer Hedworth, will be here to discuss his book, Policing Welfare, Punitive Adversarialism, and public assistance. Meanwhile, Senate Dems leased on the Budget Committee on agreement on a $3.5 trillion infrastructure package. Yesterday, in what amounts to a hollow gesture, Joe Biden decries attacks on voting. Speaking of hollow gestures, Joe Manchin meets with the Texas state lawmakers who attempt to deny the Senate quorum there. Tennessee stops vaccination outreach for young people for all vaccinations, not just COVID, all of them. Meanwhile, Missouri and Arkansas, COVID cases surge. Fourth Circuit Federal Court says the right to bear arms now applies to under 21-year-olds, presumably just 18 and 20-year-olds, but I mean, who knows? Chuck Schumer to propose federal decriminalization of weed. California Democrat Zoe Lofgren attacks Democratic antitrust legislation behind closed doors, reminding members of the vast sums of money she raises from big tech. Maybe not such a compelling argument. Texas sued over its anti-abortion vigilante law. And Bill de Blasio plans to move New York unhoused from COVID-safe hotels to group homes. And that idea is quashed by a judge. Lastly, Norwegian Cruise Line sues Florida to be allowed to require vaccinations for its passengers that presumably they want to keep healthy. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Hello. I'm well. I mean, I would imagine the Norwegian cruise lines also are just still stinging from the disaster at the start of COVID. So they're trying to limit their liability in every single way.
It's just,
That's common sense for a cruise.
True.
Those things are just petri dishes.
Well, they're already petri dishes pre-COVID.
One wonders if Florida is going to pass a law saying that you need to, you cannot fight the norovirus on the cruises as well.
Right. Everyone needs to have E. coli if you're going on Norwegian cruises.
But it's also a an illustration that, and frankly, I believe that the government has a right to tell businesses what they can and cannot do. But it does show, I think, that the questions of, you know, so-called vaccine passports or the notion that it was the lockdowns that were inhibiting businesses fundamentally is simply not the case. The majority of people in this country, maybe just barely, but the majority of people in this country believe that COVID is real. and believe the data that shows unequivocally that the vaccine gives you some instances, mass, you know, relative to hospitalization or death, massive protection from getting infected. And they don't want to go into public spaces, particularly closed in public spaces, unless people have taken full precautions. And, you know, I think what's really astonishing about this dynamic, I mean, I think you've got to be a lunatic at this point to not want the vaccine, but people have the right to be a lunatic. But the resent and the anger and the righteousness from people who still maintain that COVID is fake, you don't need to take any precautions, that somehow it's offensive, the idea that a business would say, yeah, we just want everybody vaccinated because that's our business is sort of predicated on people feeling safe.
Well, now they care about discrimination, conservatives.
Right.
Right. When it's a public health issue.
But it is demented, and it is going to lead to not just horrible outcomes in the context of COVID. I think we're already starting to see the broad contours of where this might lead in terms of, not just in terms of social cohesion, but in terms of social health. I mean, the implications of this could resonate in a way that I think many people had not contemplated. Certainly I hadn't contemplated the implications of where this could lead years down the road. So not just in terms of temporally, but also in terms of like across the board on what it's going to do to things like public health. And here's what I'm talking about. Let's start first with the single most powerful elected Republican official in the country.
And the most influential politician of the past 50 years. Possibly.
Well, I mean...
Or effective.
Effective within the context of the Senate. I mean, let's you know, like, I mean, I think Donald Trump has had a sway over the Republican Party that, you know, I
should
think
have said effective.
Unrivaled. Maybe Ronald Reagan had that, but I guess that was about 50 years ago or 40 years ago anyways. But Mitch McConnell, the one thing you can say is he really, really has control over his caucus in the Senate. I mean, that's the one thing you could say about the guy.
Right.
All the nasty things. And there's only one person, I think, who doesn't think that he does. And it's only in this one circumstance.
Hmm.
And that person's name is Mitch McConnell. And it's in this circumstance.
How many times you all have heard me say this, but I'm a huge fan of vaccinations. As a polio victim myself when I was young, I've studied that disease. It took 70 years to come up with two vaccines that finally ended the polio threat. As a result of Operation Warp Speed, not one, not two, but three highly effective vaccines. And so I'm perplexed by the difficulty we have in finishing the job. If you're a football fan, we're in the red zone, but we're not in the end zone yet, and we need to keep preaching that getting the vaccine is important. Nobody knows more about that than Senator Blunt. I don't know if you want to add anything, Roy, to what I've said here, but we need to finish the job, and part of it is just convincing the American people of the importance of doing this. Everyone who knows this subject says that if you get the disease again, chances are pretty good you're not going to die from it if you get vaccinated. So I don't know how many times we have to keep saying it, but for myself, I intend to keep saying it over and over and over again. Roy?
Okay. Now, first off, kudos to Mitch McConnell for acknowledging the role that government can play in the development of vaccines, particularly in this day and age.
Sounds like socialism, but I don't know.
There is a huge amount, I would say, to Mitch McConnell that the government can do if we decide that we want to. And so I appreciate him acknowledging that. But imagine being perplexed. He says, I don't know how many times we have to say this. I don't know who the we is here.
The football metaphor, it's like, it'd be like if you have three guys on your team, they're like, scoring touchdowns is bad, actually.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Exactly. We're in the red. We're in the red zone. But, you know, somebody should tell our running back is sacking our running quarterback.
Exactly. What is that?
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine saying he's perplexed by this? Well, apparently the reporters who were there also can't imagine it.
Respectfully, though, it isn't all that perplexing. There are Republicans who are casting doubt on the vaccine. Senator Johnson hosting an event spotlighting the rare side effects. That's where this hesitancy is coming from members of your own party casting doubt on vaccines. What are your conversations with Senator Johnson, other Republicans who are casting doubt on the vaccine?
Yeah, I've already answered the question about how I feel about this. I can only speak for myself, and I just did a few minutes ago.
Oh, you can only speak for yourself. That's a first.
I mean, if he's only speaking for himself, I have a question. Who cares?
Right.
Who cares?
He might as well be giving like a review of a TV show he saw last night. Gobbledygook. If you're not going to wield your power, which you love to do. I mean, he's the Tywin Lannister of the Senate.
Why don't they just find a staffer to give that press conference? If it doesn't matter that he's the leader of the Senate, of the Republicans in the Senate, and it's completely irrelevant that he is making football metaphors. We get the team, all the teams here. I'm the coach. I'm the quarterback. And I'm not going to say anything to the running back who's decided to like just... He's waiting to just kick a... I don't know. He's just like jogging down the other...
He gets the handoff and he sits down.
Yeah, he's like... He decides to throw the ball out of bounds or something. And this is... The Democrats should be pounding on this.
Because
they should think about like what the Republicans say one thing about Ilhan Omar, and then the Democrats are tied up for 6 weeks dealing with it. The Democrats, they failed to do this with Mitch McConnell when it came to Donald Trump. They fail to do this each and every time. They don't seem to understand how to play this game. If you've got a reporter who's just sitting there going, wait, excuse me. I mean, seriously, how could you not understand what the dynamic is here? John Boehner refused to tell members of his caucus, stop pushing legislation that says that Barack Obama is not an American citizen. The Democrats should be calling on Mitch McConnell right now to censure Ron Johnson for going around and doing this. And here's the implications. It doesn't just end with COVID. Tennessee, which has been experiencing a massive explosion of COVID, you got kids on ventilators in their hospitals. Not only are they now, and I think we mentioned this yesterday, the head of the vaccine outreach program in the state basically was forced to quit or was fired for doing outreach for the vaccine. Now, the Tennessee Health Authority has been told, you're not allowed to do outreach about not just the COVID vaccine, any vaccine. Play this clip.
What has it been like to be a public health official in Tennessee?
This is a job that I absolutely love. It's work that I love. The people that I work with, the on-the-ground people in the Tennessee Department of Health are amazing. And they have worked themselves to exhaustion to try to help the people of Tennessee. But our leadership has been toxic to work under, and morale within the department is poor. There are state workers all over the state who fear for their jobs because they want to do the right thing, and the administration is much more interested in politics. And you know, what really concerns me is that in order to appease the legislators that were upset about this memo, our leadership of the Department of Health has instructed the Department of Health to no longer do outreach around immunizations for children of any kind. That's infant immunizations, HPV immunizations in a state that has one of the highest HPV cancer rates in the country. Flu vaccine outreach in schools is being canceled for the fall. Back to school immunizations can't be messaged. National Immunization Awareness Month is in August, and we were told that we're not allowed to message that. That is the travesty. That is where the people of Tennessee have been sold out for politics, and that is frankly why I am here, is because of my 24 colleagues who have also endured this and other issues along the course of dealing with this pandemic, and someone needs to speak out about it. And so I guess that will be.
Wow. So this woman who worked as the head of the Tennessee Health Authority, she wasn't even the head of the health authority. She was just a head of the, she was the medical director for vaccine preventable diseases and immunization programs at the Tennessee Department of Health. She has the ability to speak at least for her colleagues. Mitch McConnell, however, the most powerful elected Republican official in the country, doesn't have the ability to even speak about a senator who's going around holding anti-vax town halls.
They're cheering at CPAC for low vaccination rates, and he's pretending that's some sort of organic
situation. We have no idea why this could happen.
Yeah.
The Tennessee Health Department now, according to the Tennessean paper, if the health department must issue any information about vaccines, staff are instructed to strip the agency logo off the documents. Which, you know, all of a sudden, like anything that is put out, right, could be official health stuff. Like the reason why the logo's there is not just to advertise, like maybe we'll get more business as the health department. The reason why the logo is there is so that people can have some faith
in the authority of it.
In the authority of the document that they're reading. And if you don't think in a year from now, more kids are going to die of the flu in Tennessee.
Measles.
And HPV cancers.
Which they're already, yeah, as they're saying, they have high rates there because, of course, they sexualize that vaccine for young girls as well.
Lawmakers have accused the agency of attempting to circumvent parents and peer pressure minors into being vaccinated. And then they started to discuss the idea of dissolving the entire health department to stop its vaccine departments, advertisements. Department leaders are going to be scheduled to appear before lawmakers, I guess, in like 2 weeks, a week. But here's the thing. There's no reason to believe this is going to end with Tennessee. There's no reason to believe this is going to end with Tennessee. You've got a senator from Wisconsin going around, and he's not being admonished. The Democrats should be going after Mitch McConnell right now.
Because there is a schism there, right? This is the point. He is trying to straddle a line that is impossible, where he wants business to reopen and for there to be profits for the people that fund him. He's most primarily interested in the economy, working for a specific set of people. That's his number one project. But then at the same time, he's trying to appeal to the Trump wing, which is what he was trying to do post January 6th as well, or post the election. And it's a position that's incompatible. And yet the Democrats are not pointing out that schism, and they're not making him pay the price for that fissure in his ideology and in his party. So, I mean, you're spot on with that.
Absolutely. And it's frankly reprehensible. It's reprehensible what McConnell's doing, and the Democrats failing to make this a major issue right now is also a huge mistake. It's a huge mistake. But both in terms of politics, but also, frankly, like, you know, in 3 or 4 years now, we could have 10 states that have basically gotten rid of their vaccination programs for the health departments. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Assistant Professor of Sociology, Spencer Hedworth, about policing welfare, punitive adversarialism, and public assistance. We'll be right back. Speaking of doctors, I have not used the service, but apparently half the office has. I'm certainly well aware of this scenario.
Oh, no way. Wait, is that why you were excited when we were talking about this
yes.
before the show today?
Yes.
Gotcha.
You need to see a doctor, right? You search one, you find one online that looks good. You wait on hold to book an appointment. You rearrange your schedule, and you finally go in to find out this doctor doesn't even take your insurance. There is a solution. You download the free ZocDoc app. It's the easiest way to find a great doctor and instantly book an appointment. ZocDoc, what happens is you go in. It's what kind of doctor am I looking for? What's my zip code? You search for local doctors who take your insurance. And then you read verified patient reviews. You book with an appointment. You do it in person or video chat. You never wait on hold with a receptionist again. Whether you need primary care physician, maybe you need a dentist, maybe you need a dermatologist, a psychiatrist, an eye doctor, or other specialists, ZocDoc has you covered. Hang on, yeah, actually, probably. I feel like I should visit a dermatologist just to get like a once over for, you know, skin cancer.
I was thinking I need to do that too.
I'm getting up to that age. Part of the reason why I haven't done it is because I'm like, where am I going to find? I don't know.
I just booked a new dentist through ZocDoc.
You go to ZocDoc.com/majority. You download the ZocDoc app. You sign up and you do it for free. Every month, millions of people use ZocDoc, including, apparently, Emma and Brendan. I don't know if Matt does, but they weren't here when we were talking about it. Check it out, folks. It is a great, great resource. It is both an easy way to make an appointment and also as a great resource. You know, a lot of times you just go online, you look for a doctor, you don't know anything about them. This, you could actually like compare doctors. Check it out. ZocDoc makes healthcare easy. Now is the time to prioritize your health. Go to ZocDoc.com/majority. Download the ZocDoc app for free and book a top-rated doctor. Many are available as soon as today. That's ZocDoc, ZocDoc.com/majority. Also, today's program sponsored by the same people who provided me with half my breakfast this morning. Healthy breakfast does not have to be boring. Magic Spoon has the amazing flavors you love, but without all the sugar and junk you're probably trying to avoid. Magic Spoon has 0 grams of sugar, 13, 14 grams of protein, depends on which one you get, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving, only 140 calories per serving. It is keto friendly. It is gluten free. It is grain free. It is soy free. It is low carb, and it is GMO free. And they now have the opportunity where you build your own box. You have multiple flavors. You can customize the whole thing, and they will send it to you. You know, you buy it in a box of 4 at a time. You can build your own box, or you can just get a pre-made, pre-packaged variety pack. Available flavors, cocoa, fruity, frosted, peanut butter, blueberry, and cinnamon. They also have seasonal flavors that they mix up. For me, everybody knows my go-to. I was cueing you to say
I spaced out. Sorry.
Cinnamon. Right. Cinnamon's my go-to. Although, I got to say, I had a box of cocoa peanut butter in here that was already mixed. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think that was like one of the seasonal type of thing, because you can get them separate. But when they mix it, somehow they get the perfect amount of each. Anyways, it's delicious. My kids love it. I love it.
it is good to give your kids a cereal that they don't complain about. Because if kids are like mine, they complain about everything that I put in front of them. Everything that is not like ice cream or candy. Well, it's getting a little better about it. Saul's just like, it's unbelievable. But you want some magic spoon? Yes. Boom. And I don't feel like I'm feeding them garbage. Go to magicspoon.com/majorityreport. You grab your delicious cereal. You try it today. Be sure to use our promo code MajorityReport at checkout to save $5 off your order. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, it's magicspoon.com/majorityreport. Use the code MajorityReport to save $5 off. And lastly, another product I use on a daily basis, Quip. To come out with a new dental hygiene product, I guess. Mouthwash has not changed in 140 years. Most brands are still selling big, bulky bottles that are mostly full of water and alcohol. That's why the oral care experts at Quip created a mouthwash that gives you more of the ingredients you need and that comes in an eco-friendly refill bottle that's 100% recyclable. Now, you know Quip. They make the electric toothbrush and the floss that I talk about relentlessly, and also
love
the
that
gum.
Flosser, yeah.
The flosser I is just unbelievable. I can't get over it. I mean, Saul and I literally played with it for like 20 minutes the other night because it's just, I think it's just an amazing, I think it's
And it also saves,
divine.
It's environmental, right?
It's, oh, yes.
There's none of the plastic holders you throw out.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm very helpful.
The four times concentrate mouthwash has fluoride, xylitol, and CPC, but they left out the artificial colors and the stinging alcohol you'll find in a lot of the other rinses. And with a customizable subscription, you can get refills automatically delivered straight to your door every 3 months. Quip's refill bottles are made from 100% recyclable plastic. Mouthwash is the perfect finishing touch to a complete oral care routine. You pair it with a Quip electric toothbrush. For adults and kids, they have two different sizes, refillable flossers, and Quip's great-tasting, good-for-you gum that can help keep your teeth clean between brushings. I carry my little thing around all the time. It's like a little bit of like, what do you call it? I can't remember what it is. But Quip is just a great design company, and they have made oral care easy and eco-friendly. And if you go to getquip.com/majority5 right now, you get $5 off a mouthwash starter kit. That's $5 off the mouthwash starter kit, which includes a refillable dispenser, a 90-day dose supply of Quip's four times concentrated formula at getquip.com/majority5. That's spelled getquip.com/majority5, number five. Quip, the good habits company. Okay. Want to welcome to the program assistant professor of sociology at Purdue University, affiliated scholar at the American Bar Foundation, Spencer Hedworth. He has written a book, Policing Welfare, Punitive Adversarialism in Public Assistance. Spencer, I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, all right, let's just start with, before we get to the policing of welfare, what constitutes welfare in this country? And that's not, I mean, that, you know, and I guess there's a little bit of controversy as to what really constitutes welfare, but let's talk about, lay out first, what is welfare?
I think in a comprehensive understanding of what welfare is, it includes a host of government programs that are intended to help people in various ways. And in recent years, tax credits have risen to the fore as a mechanism of welfare provision, although a mechanism of welfare provision that's overwhelmingly directed toward people who work for pay. But for the purposes of the book and for the purposes, I think, of general understanding, I treat welfare as TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, to a certain degree, and primarily SNAP. Since the 1996 welfare reform, TANF as a share of public assistance spending has declined significantly, and SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as food stamps, has taken up a lot of the slack, if you will, and grown to be a much larger program, helping many more people. So the focus of the book is on those two programs, especially SNAP, but understanding welfare as a phenomenon, I think, is to most appropriately should include a whole host of other things intended to help people in various ways.
But in the context of the cultural and I think, you know, political and ideological relationship towards welfare recipients, the idea of whether you are receiving assistance based upon the fact that you're working or not seems to be really important here too. And in terms of what you write, in terms of like the age and the difference between whether you're a deserving welfare recipient or an undeserving welfare recipient. Just talk about that so that we get like a sort of a good sense of what we're talking about here.
That's right. I think, you know, programs like Social Security Retirement Insurance and Social Security Disability Insurance are not generally, at least for the most part, thought of as welfare programs because they are directed toward people who are conventionally considered to be in the deserving poor category, people with physical disabilities, older people, people who for these reasons are presumed to be unable to work, whereas programs like SNAP and to a certain degree TANF are available to younger people, are available to people without disabilities. So they have achieved a particular prominence, I think, in the popular understanding of what welfare is, and a notoriety, if you will, that exceeds their realistic percentage of social assistance spending in this country. You know, they're much smaller than these other programs that are, you know, Medicare and Social Security Retirement Insurance that are directed to older people, but they have an outsized presence in the popular imaginary and in political demagoguery.
Okay. And so, all right. So now let's turn a little bit, turn to your book. You interviewed, I think it's 42, welfare investigators over the course of five different states. Just outline for us, you know, what broadly speaking in that way, like what your approach was and how you wanted to look at this topic, because this is not from the perspective necessarily of welfare recipients. You're looking at a mechanism to ensure that only deserving welfare recipients get welfare. And you're looking at that perspective from the perspective of the investigators. Like, I'm not even sure that people know. I mean, maybe they think about it, but I didn't really know that, like, these agencies had more or less cops, essentially. Walk us through that whole world and then who you spoke to.
Sure. I didn't know either. And I think most people don't know. When I was, you know, trying to decide what I was going to do for my big dissertation project when I was in graduate school, I knew I wanted to do something on sort of paper crimes among less privileged people, right? There's a lot of research out there about financial fraud and large-scale white-collar crime like that. I knew I was interested in some kind of paper crime among people of less means and how it's policed and laws against it are enforced. And when I began looking into this, I, you know, came across the idea of welfare fraud as something I might be interested in. Then as I was looking more into welfare fraud, I discovered the existence of these dedicated investigative units within social service agencies. So the people who work in these units are employees of an ostensibly helping-oriented agency, whatever the state-level agency that administers SNAP and TANF in your state is. And in all states except for Wisconsin, that is the same agency. Wisconsin administers theirs separately, SNAP and TANF, that is. So this immediately struck me as something I was, you know, really interested in. You've got these employees of these agencies that are supposed to be about supporting people and helping people, but their domain within that agency and their specific task and their occupational incentives are all about catching people violating rules. So as I looked more into it, You know, I discovered that as of 1985, since 1985, the federal law, the Food Security Act of 1985, has required states to maintain and operate these dedicated investigative units within their social service agencies. So this is a mandate that comes down from the federal government. And they look different in different states. Different states place different degrees of emphasis on welfare fraud, SNAP fraud, and TANF fraud as a problem. Allocate different amounts of resources toward policing it, and demonstrate, you know, different levels of interest in criminalizing people, literally pressing criminal charges against people for these offenses. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to, once I discovered these things existed and that there was this federal mandate, that was one of the reasons I wanted to look at some different states. So I selected five different states across the country based on their variation in terms of the size of their public assistance population, the sort of overall socioeconomic characteristics of the state, and the punitiveness of their conventional criminal justice system as measured by their incarceration rate. So I picked these five states and traveled to them to do interviews with, yes, welfare fraud investigators, as well as other people who are involved in the system, managers, supervisors, data analysts. You know, some states have really pushed forward with relatively sophisticated database matching technologies and things and are employing specialists in those areas. So I interviewed people in these various states, got a pretty good sense of what each state's system looked like from those interviews. And so, as you point out, the resulting picture is one of the enforcement side of the system. And that was an intentional choice on my part. There's been some other really excellent research on welfare clients, on their relationship to welfare rules, on their experiences in the programs. I would note here, especially Karin Gustafson's work. She's a law professor at UC Irvine who wrote a book, Cheating Welfare, which I sort of think of as an intellectual predecessor to my book. And so I wanted to look at the other side of the system, right? The people who are doing the enforcement work, how this system works and what it means for people who are potentially interested in participating in public assistance programs or who are clients of public assistance programs, as well as our general understanding of how we approach, you know, problems of poverty in the United States.
What I think is fascinating about your work is it is both you're studying something that is both a reflection of an attitude that has real and political importance in terms of what material benefits the state, and by the state, I don't mean even like a specific state. I'm talking about our government provides for its citizenry on one hand. On the other hand, it also functions as a mechanism to basically limit. It's like almost like a self-perpetuating type of machine here, because it also it materially limits people's involvement in these programs. It also has it reinforces the cultural catalyst for the existence of these things, right? I mean, and so how much, and then I want to go into some of the details as to what they do, because what they do is really, I think, far more oppressive than people would imagine. And then ultimately, by any measure other than the ones that we just talked about in terms of propaganda value, it seems to me, is a useless endeavor. Just on a sheer dollar for dollar basis, particularly when you compare it to, like, for every dollar you get, you put into the IRS. But let's just start with this. Like, I'm just curious, did you find a correlation between carceral rates and the intensity of the investigation of welfare people, A, and B, was there a correlation between, for lack of a better term, blue or red state, one that has, you know, at least some ostensibly less hostility to the idea of government providing services and the way that people who use these services are policed?
Yeah, so a number of great points there in regards to the last question. I want to be cautious about making big statements about it looks like this in red states and it looks like this in blue states, because I only have a 5-state sample and I only talked to some of the people in those states. You know, it's not a big nationally representative survey. So caveat there. But I did find in my investigation, it includes two conventionally red states, two conventionally blue states, and one kind of purple state. And the specific states are confidential, the names of the states. But I did find that the two conventionally red states, as well as the purple state, were the most intense in their welfare fraud investigation approaches, and the two red states are among the national leaders in incarceration rates as well. And that includes, that greater intensity includes a couple of relatively notable things. One is a much greater focus on what I call in the book shoe leather investigations, right? So actually going out, going, talking to people's neighbors, knocking on their doors, going through their homes, doing stakeouts, right, where you wait outside someone's house and see if there's a person who has not been reported as living there, who spends the night there and then gets up and goes to work the next morning to establish a household composition violation potentially. So those types of approaches are particularly intense in the more conventionally conservative states that were in my sample. Conversely, the kind of more database driven, more technologically sophisticated approach is really highlighted by one of the blue states. So take that for what you will. Another aspect of the differences between the states is the red states are also much more interested, both in terms of their kind of express commitment to it, as well as the statistics I was able to get regarding overall patterns in referring people for criminal prosecution. So the blue states do much less of that. Rarely will they try to refer someone for criminal prosecution. The red states are much more zealous about saying, we're going to investigate this case, we're going to put together our portfolio on this person, what happened here, and send it to the district attorney's office and ask them to prosecute it. One of the states includes in their welfare fraud system sworn peace officers, you know, people who carry guns and go undercover and go into places like homeless shelters and particular neighborhoods they've identified as problem areas in attempting to catch people engaged in what they call SNAP trafficking, which is exchanging an EBT card with SNAP benefits for cash or some type of goods, right? That more conventionally criminal justice focused type of approach is more common in my, again, limited sample in the red states.
Talk about the system of just essentially snitching or tips, right? Where, you know, what kind of, I know this is you're focused more on the data here, but I'm just curious about the intended effect of having a system where people are incentivized to essentially rat out, if they know anybody who is by subjective standards not appropriately receiving welfare benefits, and just like what that says overall about the enforcement system that you researched.
Sure. As you know, Emma, this is not something that I spend a lot of time on in the book. It is something that I wrote about in an article that came out a couple years ago in the American Sociological Review. So if you're interested in that, that article would be the main place to look. It's called Getting to Know You, Welfare Fraud Investigation and the Appropriation of Social Ties. And in that article, and a little bit in the book, but primarily in the article, I talk about how these welfare fraud investigators use people's social networks to get incriminating information about them. And they do that a couple of different ways. One is a sort of proactive avenue on the part of the investigators, where they actively go out to people's neighborhoods, knock on doors, and ask your neighbor, like, do you know what's going on in that house over there, right? Do you know who lives there? Do you know if they work? These types of things, right? And then there's a more passive avenue on the part of the investigators, but one that they describe as nevertheless quite effective, which are welfare fraud hotlines, tip lines, online reporting systems, phone numbers you can call, actively seeking to incriminate someone else. So instead of them seeking you out for information, you're seeking out enforcement authorities. Through those avenues, they say, the welfare fraud investigators say, a lot of the reports that they get are people who are mad about something else, right? It's someone who is mad because their neighbor kept them up with their dogs barking, or they, you know, have a disagreement over unpaid child support or whatever the nature of the personal beef might be. And then that gets translated into using this apparatus of state control as a mechanism for, you know, engaging in interpersonal warfare, right? Interpersonal disputes. So their eagerness to use these types of snitches, if you will, is, I think, you know, a testament to the fact that they are outcome oriented, right? The welfare fraud investigators are, they have quotas. They have a certain number of investigations they need to complete every month or every quarter. And they are strongly incentivized both by their superiors within state government and by the federal government financially to substantiate as many cases of fraud as they can. So wherever they think they can get incriminating information, they're on board. And people who live in the neighborhood, people with personal connections to clients or applicants are valuable sources of information, right? They know things that would take an investigator potentially a while to figure out, like how often so-and-so sleeps at that house. There are reasons that they are also skeptical of these types of reports. So they don't just, you know, take things that people tell them at face value. They're leads that then get followed up on and substantiated further. With this capacity to provide access to information that is generally not going to be available to an outsider, like a welfare fraud investigator, these types of reports from people in clients' lives are really valuable.
It must make for a great neighborhood where you have weaponized all your neighbors given empowered people that you may have had like some type of, you know, petty dispute with. I don't like the way that that guy, you know, parks his bike out in front of the house. So, you know, we're going to weaponize this. So because I'm trying to build up to the actual sort of value of each of these things. But before we get there, just outline for us how this works. So the federal government says block grants most of this stuff, right? Although SNAP is not quite that way, right? The federal government says you can use a percentage of, how does it work? How do they decide how much money they're going to expend on enforcement, right? Because at the end of the day, theoretically, if this was about all the loss that we have in fraud to this and making this thing efficient, the mechanism that they would deploy to find this fraud out would work into some type of efficiency calculus, right? And so we would get a return on the dollar, each dollar that we spend. How is it determined how much money is allocated towards this type of policing?
It's largely up to the state. So the federal government has their own types of enterprises where they're engaged in their own separate stuff, right? So the United States Department of Agriculture, which runs the SNAP program, specifically Food and Nutrition Services within the USDA, they have their own unit that's focused on retailers. So stores that are believed to be participating in SNAP trafficking, allowing people to exchange cards for cash, those types of things. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has a big Medicaid fraud investigation thing, and they have units that are federal units located within all the 50 states. So they do their own stuff, right? But in terms of what happened,
that's not the client that they're looking at now, right? They're looking at the sort of they're looking at the other end, the provider, essentially, fraud. And that's usually like companies or, businesses. And so the point is that when they engage in fraud, they're getting multiple streams of government support because they're collecting from different people who are clients. When a client engages in fraud, it's only this one person, right? Or this one family, and they only have control, if you will, of a very limited amount of money. Like when we're talking about a welfare recipient, whether it's TAMF or whether it's food stamps, what's the biggest amount of money on a monthly basis this person could be in control of, I guess?
A few hundred dollars. So the average the average SNAP recipient during the period I was collecting data was getting about $146 a month. And you can, you know, up that with more, a larger household, but we're not talking about thousands of dollars a month, right? At the client level.
So, so these states are deploying people to surveil, to sit outside and do a stakeout to see if these people are abusing their $140 a month payment.
Seems like a good use of resources.
Yeah. If these surveillers are getting like 3 cents an hour.
Yeah. So, I mean, to get to the question you were building to, Sam, they don't go out of their way. Excuse me. They don't go out of their way.
It's allergy season still,
I guess.
Always.
To advertise what the average return on investment is, but you can calculate it via available numbers. And it's about $240 that they get back per post-certification investigation in SNAP. So I don't know exactly how much one investigation costs, but with labor and overhead and computers and everything else, it's almost certainly more than $240.
So their average recovery is $240. And I'm trying to think like it seems impossible that you could be investing so little money in recovering that $240 that this is a net positive, right? I mean, the point being that ultimately, you know, it's one thing to say like the estimates for the IRS are somewhere between, and these estimates are coming from the IRS. I mean, they have hard data on this. You've got, so I think it's 6 or 7 to 1 for every $1 you spend on IRS enforcement, you get $7 back. And in this instance, I'd be surprised if it's even remotely close to like you get 70 cents back on every dollar. I mean, to get back only $240, it seems to me that like it's probably more likely you get 50 cents back for every dollar that you go in. We're losing money for this. So if that is the case, and somebody must realize that, right? I mean, they could argue, well, it keeps people off the rolls because it makes it so onerous that it's a miserable experience. And incidentally, if anybody wants to know why there's not a one-to-one correlation on people who get things like TAMF and who they vote for, you know, that they engage in voting, this is part of it, right? Because the experience is so miserable and that it's designed to keep people off the system and also to stigmatize them.
Yeah, and that's that is an explicit point of emphasis for the investigators. Is it's not just about money, it's about sending a message and making it less comfortable to participate and getting people kicked off. Because when you are found to have committed an intentional program violation, you get suspended for a year. A second one, you get suspended for 2 years. A third one, you're disqualified permanently from ever participating in the program again. So that is a big part of the calculus for them explicitly. And it's not one that an easy dollars and cents calculation lends itself to, because you are doing symbolic stuff that is hard to measure. And you're also removing people from the program where it's unclear how much they would have cost in the future. And when these agencies calculate what they call cost avoidance, they are, I think, fairly aggressive in their estimations of how much someone would have participated in the future before being suspended or disqualified. And we know from lots of research that people participate intermittently. They don't participate consistently. They're on, they're off, they're working, they're not. That's just part of being poor, is instability and difficulty in life circumstances like that. So they're quite aggressive in saying, you know, this person definitely would have continued to receive this amount of benefits for the foreseeable future. So they do produce calculations that suggest that they quote unquote pay for themselves or even produce a net profit. But again, those calculations are based on largely unknowable and usually overly, in my opinion, overly aggressively estimated figures on how much someone would have continued to draw out of the program had they not been disqualified or suspended.
Right. I mean, these investigators have quite a vested interest in the idea that they're saving a ton of money for people. But I mean, again, with $150 a month in let's say SNAP benefits, I mean, it would take a couple of years before you get up to like, you know, $3,000. And so it really is stunning to me. Let's just talk a little bit. We just have a couple of minutes left here of the history of this. 85, it obviously, this provision came in during the Reagan years. I remember Ronald Reagan talking about the welfare queens and, you know, paying for lobster with their food stamps type of situation. But there was no mitigation of this by the Clinton administration. In fact, TANF, in some way, when they got rid of the AFDC, was a it ended up allowing for work requirements, and it promoted this idea that people who are on welfare are, you know, trying to pull something, a fast one on all of us.
Yeah. So, I mean, historically, it's not new, right? These types of things go back all the way to English poor law in the 15th century. But yeah, it really escalates during the Reagan years. And like a lot of, I think, related tough on crime type of thinking and tough on crime type of lawmaking, it demonstrates remarkable bipartisan consensus. And yeah, the Clinton era, of course, was marked by him fulfilling his promise to end welfare as we know it, and shepherding through with the, obviously the help of the Republicans in Congress, but shepherding through the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act of 1996, PRWORA, that replaced AFDC with TANF, ended the previous entitlement status for AFDC, established the $16.5 billion block grant for TANF, which has not changed since 1996, functionally losing value every year. And so this is this notion of poor people as parasitic and as actively engaged in, you know, mendacious acts of violence, if you will, against the body politic by quote unquote stealing money. Not historically new, but definitely reached a fever pitch in the 1980s under Reagan, who, you know, famously used the welfare fraud parables to advance his political fortunes and as a motivation and justification for actual things that he got done while in office. And then, yeah, continues apace in the Clinton era. And it's, I think, you know, had ebbs and flows since then, but this general consensus of welfare fraud is a big problem and we need to be very active in going after it, that has not really faded as a national political matter.
And when you look at things like carceral rates and you look at all of this stuff tracks on some level, right? I mean, and it seems to perpetuate itself. One lends credence to the other, et cetera, et cetera, it seems. We just in this infrastructure bill, hopefully it was certainly when the COVID relief, there was a $300 a tax credit for folks with children. And really all you need to have is children. You don't need to, I mean, there's a cutoff. I think it's like $112,000 for an individual, $150,000 for a couple. Which basically encompasses the vast majority of Americans. It's with kids. So there's that requirement. And obviously it's tax credit. So there's an employment element to this too. But that type of mechanism where, like, what has anybody done any studies of, like, you know what? What if we didn't have all the requirements that it takes? Like, you just come in and you say, answer these three questions and you get your $142 a month or whatever it is. Maybe, you know, for the larger family, it's a little bit bigger. Well, has anybody done any estimates as to sort of like, would that really cost more or would it cost less? Right? I mean, the mechanism to create efficiency seems to be incredibly inefficient and stigmatizing.
Yeah. So the, I mean, economists have looked at this. I'm not an economist, so I don't want to speak for their field. I believe there is also some disunity there, but there are certainly people who say that, yeah, universal basic income would be cheaper. You would certainly, as you point out, avoid all these administrative costs. You would avoid stigmatization. You would avoid putting people in cycles that just lead to further immiseration and lack of capacity to create financial self-sufficiency, right? Having a welfare fraud charge on your record is just another thing that's going to make it harder for you to get on solid financial footing and, you know, advance your financial fortunes, maybe, you know, aspire to upward social mobility. And that's particularly the case when these things become not just administrative matters, but criminal matters, right? When you get to the point of giving someone an entry or another entry on a criminal record, you're making it that much harder for them to get a job, to find a place to live, to have, you know, parental rights, all types of things that can be placed into jeopardy by these types of charges, and all types of things that we know as criminologists and sociologists are very strongly correlated with, you know, future problems, whether that be with the legal system, whether that be with finances, whether that be with partners, the list goes on and on.
All right. Well, listen, we've got to sign off to our Peacock viewers, but I would like to hang on because I've got a couple more questions to ask you about this that, you know, because I think people don't necessarily have the full scope of understanding of just how intrusive this stuff is and how picky what can constitute a violation. So if you can hang around for just a couple more minutes while we say goodbye to our Peacock viewers and encourage you to tune in tomorrow for our program on the Choice channel.
I will be hosting just me. So if you are already sick of this person,
good day to take
tune
a break
in,
from
make
me.
Sure the ratings are better on Thursdays.
There you go.
Thanks.
We'll see you then. In the meantime, Spencer, so getting back to, I want, like, would you sort of outline for folks like exactly what's in, like, how specific in what investigators can do? Like, if you are getting SNAP, for instance, if you're buying food with SNAP, with a SNAP card, they could come into your house to make sure you're not commingling your food with, let's say, your roommate or your boyfriend or your girlfriend.
That's right. So the federal courts have ruled a series of times that participating in these public assistance programs entails, according to the court's perspective, a voluntary release of privacy expectations, right? So that means that normal Fourth Amendment protections against search and seizure without a warrant, right, do not apply here. And yes, as a participant, you are generally required to allow people into your home to inspect things like your food, whether or not it is divided, whether you're, you know, purchasing and preparing together in the language of SNAP, and also more, well, arguably more intrusive, but certainly more personal things like, you know, if you are a woman who is reported being a single woman, are there men's clothes in your house, right? Are there men's shoes in your house? Are there indications that someone is living here who you've not reported as living here? And, you know, these fraud investigators that I interviewed tell me stories about going into people's houses and finding men hiding, right? Hiding under the bed, hiding in the shower, you know, literally obscuring themselves, trying to avoid getting caught somewhere that they were not supposed to be according to the rules of the program. So yeah, it is, with the blessing of the federal courts, it is a situation where your normal expectations of constitutional protections are not provided. And that also applies to things like Fifth Amendment protections against self-incrimination. that don't apply to the hearings where these charges are adjudicated and so forth.
So let me ask you, I'm curious about if any of this stuff has been challenged in court recently, because, you know, there was just a ruling at the Supreme Court, Cedar Point, I think it was, which basically said, like, you know, it's a taking if the government forces union organizer allow, you know, forces the employer to allow union organizers to come on and organize agricultural workers a certain amount of hours a day. Well, I mean, presumably the government is associated in giving these farms, like, you know, I don't know, tax subsidies, right? It's like a tax credit or has provided other benefits, government benefits to this farming. And if they can't require you know, some time set aside for union representatives, that they can't. Can they also say, like, oh, well, you guys need to let somebody into your apartment, trespass in there and see if, like, you know, your box of cereal is commingled with your roommate's box of cereal? Or I just got an IM from somebody who said, I was fined in Illinois when my eldest child started working at age 15 and I failed to report it in my assessment. It was a tiny income she used on makeup. So if the kid wanted to go get a job at age 15 so that I can, you know, she can buy, like, you know, whatever clothes, or, you know, I want to get new sneakers, you can get fined for not reporting that as an assessment that would put you over the edge or something. I mean, this is just, it is so draconian, and I don't think people understand just how draconian it is. And it's just twisted. It's twisted.
I'm unaware of major challenges recently. There may be matters in the lower courts that I haven't heard of. I think your idea of using the Cedar Point ruling as a potential entree to a challenge is interesting. However, I can't imagine, given the current makeup of the high court, that there's likely to be a decision following that logic. So I would not hold out hope for such a ruling, at least in the near term. And I think another discouraging fact with regard to litigation is the fact that when these matters have come up in the past, the courts have been quite consistent. And I don't believe, again, especially given the current makeup of the Supreme Court, that we are likely to see any diversion from established precedent in this area.
All right. Lastly, what did you find in terms of race? And I don't know what would be your measure when you go into these states, you know, how to assess the race relations quotient, or how big is racism in this state, or, you know, but in the course of, if you do have like a data point, I'm curious about that, but in the course of dealing with these investigators, like, how much did race play a part in some of this?
Sure. So, most of the investigators and administrators and managers that I interviewed were white. They were not all white. There were people of color, a couple Latino people, and a number of African-American people. So it's the constitution of the enforcement enterprise is certainly more white and more male than the overall constitution of the client population. Race and gender are all over the history of welfare. Racism and sexism are all over the history of welfare, and especially movements to restrict welfare, to control welfare recipients, to punish people on welfare. So that is a huge backdrop for this project. It's a big part of the general world that we're in here. But my data don't offer a ton into this question. So I, of course, wanted to ask people about this, but I also didn't want to make them overly defensive or protective, right? It's one of the things you'd have to negotiate in doing this kind of research. So, I framed a question about this to everyone in terms of social groups, right? Do you see any patterns in welfare rule violation among members of different social groups, right? Or people who have been on the program a long time or just got on, or people who just moved here, or people who lived here a long time, those types of things, hoping that this would cue them to talk about race, among other things. And it did. When they heard social groups, they heard race to a substantial degree. And what I got out of them on this question was a quite uniform commitment to colorblind ideology, to the idea that, you know, it's not about race, that what we do is, you know, uniform. And the a lot of people went out of their way, I think, to raise the fact that they see lots of people of all types of different backgrounds committing welfare fraud, that it's not just people from this group or that group. You know, a number of investigators went out of their way to say that other people think that, you know, it's all Black people that are committing welfare fraud or something like that. And that's not the case. That's not what they see. You know, it just matters where you're working, what the local population there looks like, and so forth. So that's the general tenor of their response on this. I did have a handful of people who were making statements that were, you know, racially coded, you know, talking about welfare clients who are going to get their nails done, which I, you know, take as a racially coded thing. One white interviewee definitely adopted like a stereotypically African-American style of speech when she was impersonating a client to me. Some of these types of things. But overall, the general finding on race from my interviews was that they are quite steadfast in saying that race is not a factor in what they do.
They just, it is to the extent that they had any predisposition, it was maybe class-based. I mean, did they even go like the vast majority of people that we deal with are, you know, are trying to, you know, just to get by and are really deserving of this, or I don't even know what that concept means. I mean, were they like that, or was it, you know, I mean, I've had some experience in interaction with police, and they their perspective on the world is a lot darker than your average person. They see a lot of crime, and they perceive that as, you know, it's as if someone was only watching local news every, you know, every hour out of the day. And they presume that, you know, there's all sorts of like, the whole world is tragic. But was there that dynamic?
Yeah. So, one of the things that people varied on quite a bit is their assessment of what clients as a whole look like, how many of them are quote unquote really struggling versus actually comfortable, and especially clients who violate rules. So I got a range of responses when I asked people about, you know, what share of clients who violate rules are really struggling, from, you know, some people saying that, you know, most clients are really struggling, they're just trying to get by, to other people saying most of them are actually comfortable and they're just greedy, right? They're fine financially. They don't need this. They're just, they're greedy. They're self-interested. They're actively engaged in, you know, trying to make a profit off of these programs. So a lot of variation there. But in general,
Did that variation correlate at all with the states?
Maybe to a certain degree. I think that perspective was perhaps a little more common in the red states. I can say for certain that a couple of the two people who stand out as having sort of the most sociological perspective on the issue in my reckoning, in terms of, you know, these people are in difficult situations, they're doing whatever they can to survive, they both came from East Coast, which is a state in the Northeast that is a blue state. And one of them in particular made just a wonderful point. You know, he was asking me, like, you know, what kind of credit card do you have in your wallet? You have a Visa. Okay. So what's the policy on your Visa if your billing statement ends on the last Friday of the month, but it's a leap year, right? And so I didn't say anything. He said, you don't know. Of course you don't know, because you don't read the fine print. You don't know what your rider says. But you can trust that that system is organized fairly enough to treat you fairly, right? And that if you make a mistake, it will be handled rationally. But the people who are participating in this program, they don't have that luxury, right? They don't have the ability to just assume that the system will treat them fairly. And then, you know, he went on to note that most of his clients that he deals with are people who, you know, don't know their last name. They don't know when they were born. They've struggled with substance abuse issues for years, if not decades, and to hang this crime on them for a situation that is almost certainly entirely, if not almost entirely, or almost entirely, if not entirely outside of their control is twisted, in your words.
Spencer Hedworth, assistant professor of sociology at Purdue University, author of Policing Welfare Punitive Adversarialism in Public Assistance. We will put a link to that on our blog. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right, folks. I'm a little long today. Just really sort of stunning that had the sort of the price associated with getting that meager assistance is pretty stunning.
Yeah, it's by design.
And by design. All right, folks, we're going to take a break and head into the fun app. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you get the free show free of commercials, and then you get the fun half. Also, don't forget our Discord, majoritydiscord.com. You can get our app, and I am the show at majorityapp.com. Also support our one of our movement sponsors, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. Matt, what is happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, tonight at 8 Eastern on Left Reckoning, the YouTube channel, go subscribe. Victor Poggi, Intercept in Brazil, talking about Lula, Bolsonaro, and I mean Bolsonaro. There's some Bolsonaro news today. He's in the hospital for hiccups.
For hiccups, yeah.
For his 10th day of hiccups.
It's like something I would have wanted as a child, right? Not wanted. Never mind. Keep
hiccup,
going.
Just hiccup day off from school.
Oof. Yeah. Well,
I don't know.
That's where I was going.
I'd rather be sick with like vomiting than hiccuping.
Me too. That's torture.
Really?
That's tonight, 8 Eastern. If you want the post game, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back. Bye.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what? What? Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank, okay? I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black, African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Back. Africans are black. Black. Alpha males are black. Black. Africans are back. Back.
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.